Hello, I'm Kara Lamar. Welcome to the STLE Compass, brought to you by the Society of Tribologists and Lubrication Engineers. The STLE Compass is your convenient and reliable resource for the latest developments in the tribology community. This is another episode of the STLE Compass, and today the focus is on nanotribology. Nanotribology, as defined in the TLT article from January 2009, is the study of interfacial phenomena at the nanoscale. At the nanoscale, there are radically different conditions and tribological concerns when compared to a normal scale. Today, we will get an inside look at nanotribology and MEMS, or microelectrical mechanical systems. Our interviewee is an authority on these microsystems. Dr. Michael Duggar is a distinguished member of the technical staff at Sandia National Laboratories, where he received his PhD in material science from Northwestern University and joined Sandia National Laboratories in the same year. He is presently a distinguished member of the technical staff in the Material Science and Engineering Center at Sandia. He conducts a wide range of fundamental to applied research in tribology, including friction and wear in microelectrical mechanical systems, or MEMS, solid lubricants and hard coatings, particulate contamination, sliding electrical contact materials, and extremely high-speed interfaces. He is on the board of directors and a fellow of STLE, and is past chair of the Nanotribology and Micro-Nanosystems Committee of ASME. Today, we will get an inside look into his research and examine the field of nanotribology and MEMS. So, Mike, welcome to the STLE Compass.
Thank you, Kara.
Thanks for being here with us, and thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
No problem.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the title? What do you mean by room at the bottom?
Yeah, that was actually kind of a nod to the late Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman. He did a lecture at Caltech in December of 1959 entitled There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom. And what he was talking about was the possibility in the future of being able to directly manipulate matter at the atomic scale. And if you could do that, then you could enable all sorts of advancements in synthetic chemistry, biology, and even mechanics. He actually envisioned building machines that would automatically assemble other machines of slightly smaller scale, and then those machines would build still smaller machines, and so on, until finally you were able to fabricate, or these machines, rather, were able to fabricate devices down at the molecular scale. So he, for that reason, he's sort of viewed as the father of nanotechnology. I mean, not really predicted, but just thinking about the possibilities, thought that in the near future such a thing might be possible. And while we're not quite there yet, I mean, we're still, when we make micro machines, for example, which we'll talk about later, we're using fabrication technologies that are still macro scale, but we use things like photographic methods and lithography, the same sort of techniques used to make integrated circuits to make these small machines. And I think there's still opportunity for scaling that down and making ever smaller machines. And what I mean by the title, the reason I chose that there's still plenty of room at the bottom, is we've only really scratched the surface in what we can do in that area. There's still plenty of opportunities in nanotechnology. We're just beginning to understand how sort of atoms and molecules can be manipulated and what we can do at that size scale. And particularly in the case of nanotribology, we've only just begun to understand how interactions between atoms are manifested at the larger scale.
That's amazing. There are so many different options, and as new technologies come about, then you have other options and things that you might not have envisioned at the beginning. So that's certainly a good start. So how would you describe the field of nanotribology? What is it exactly?
Well, really, it's just the study of the interactions of small collections of atoms. So in nanotechnology, that definition would apply as well. But in nanotribology, we're studying the interactions of these small collections of atoms, typically involving some sort of an interface and relative motion between one group of atoms and another. And experimentally, the tools have just recently become available to measure those kinds of interactions, things like atomic force microscopy, this device called the surface forces apparatus, which allows analysis of very small fluid and very small gaps, for example, and things like nanoindentation, where we can probe the mechanical response of materials at cubic nanometers of material, those kinds of volumes. And then the capabilities of transmission electron microscopes, also some of these tools that I just mentioned, like atomic force microscopy, or typically referred to as AFM, people are putting those tools inside of transmission electron microscopes now. So not only can you sort of push on one surface with another, but you can use the TEM, the electron microscope, to watch what's going on, to watch motions of dislocations or individual groups of atoms. And then further, so that's from sort of the experimental side. There's also computational experimental tools like molecular dynamics that people are beginning to use. So these are models, or computer models, or simulations of how groups of atoms interact with one another. And the way those experiments, or they call them simulations in the community, the way that work is done is you prescribe the forces between individual atoms using something called a potential, and then you assemble a large group of atoms, say two surfaces, and then you allow that model to evolve in response to some external stimulus, like pressing the surfaces together and then sliding one past another. The challenge in doing that right, of course, is describing the correct potential that accounts for all the forces between the atoms. And that's a lot more complicated than it sounds.
I would imagine.
Right. So the entire art in getting that right is using a correct potential that describes the phenomena that you're interested in. And there's still a lot of challenge in that area. I mean, a lot of the potentials involve just sort of the pressure and mechanical forces, that sort of thing. There's not a lot of chemistry in some of those models. It's just, I'd say in the last decade, there's been a lot of progress in developing things called reactive bond order potentials, which allow chemistry to happen inside of these models, in addition to just sort of deflection of balls on springs in a mechanical sort of a model. And the ability to do those simulations is still limited by just raw computing power, frankly. I mean, a million atom simulation is a large one, and that still just describes a very tiny volume of material. That might be one asperity in one of our sort of macroscale surfaces that we're familiar with.
Sure. So why would it be important to look at things at the nano level?
Well, ultimately, everything that happens between surfaces, you know, the gears in the transmission in your car, and when you walk across the sidewalk, all those interfacial interactions are the result of interactions that occur at the nanoscale. It's just the integrated response of all those individual atomic interactions. And so there's, on a surface, there's something like 10 to the 15th atoms per square centimeter, and it's the interaction of all of those atoms collectively that produce the responses that we just normally encounter in our everyday lives. And historically, you know, tribologists have developed relationships between, for example, the wear properties of a surface and the mechanical contact conditions, or the properties of fluids and their hydrodynamic behavior, and so on. And there's relatively few areas in tribology where there's a really mature theoretical description based on both material properties of how these surfaces interact. In hydrodynamic lubrication, for example, as long as the fluids are sort of well-behaved and have relatively simple molecules that don't change a lot over ranges of temperature and pressure, then the shear force can be predicted actually quite well over some range of temperature and pressure. When you talk about the interaction of solid surfaces, that's not quite true. You might be amazed to know that, you know, here we are in the 21st century and it's still extremely challenging, and we're not able to predict, say, the macroscopic friction coefficients that will be observed between two solids that are sliding based on atomic scale interactions. I mean, we know things like phonons, which are vibrations of the crystal lattice in a solid, for example, and plasmons, which are sort of electronic vibrations, if you will. Chemical bond breaking happens and those sorts of things, but we're not able to take those atomic scale phenomena and explain exactly what's going to happen at the macro scale in a predictive way.
Given the fact that there is so much complication, and even in the smallest, even with the smallest amount of atoms, some other challenges, or what are the biggest technical challenges that you run into?
Well, ultimately, the holy grail in this field is the bridge length scale, so we can take, for example, what's happening with individual happen at the larger scale. And what's really making that possible is development of experimental tools and computational tools that have happened in, say, the last 20 to 30 years. The atomic force microscope, which we mentioned earlier, AFM, and a lot of these tools really involve very precise measurements of displacement using things like lasers and photodetectors, optical interference techniques, and so on. And it's the careful calibration of those tools that's important so that displacements and hence forces can be measured correctly, so we can understand exactly what's going on, quantify the forces at the atomic scale. And you also have to be careful about contamination. When you're dealing with, say, in an atomic force microscope, you have a tip with a radius of curvature that's just a few nanometers at the very end. So you're dealing with, you know, tens to hundreds of atoms potentially in contact at the end of that tip. Contamination can be a big issue. You might not have the molecules on the end of that tip that you think you do. So you go and make a measurement, and now it's the measurement of some phenomena having to do with the contaminant film rather than, for example, the silicon or the tungsten tip atoms and the surface that you're interested in.
Given the different challenges and just the fact that you're studying it, what would be some commercial applications or some other implications of nanotribology? Are there any specific products that are being developed that rely on nanotribology principles?
Well, there's one that, you know, kind of the 800-pound gorilla that all of us interact with every day, and that's our computers. Still, most data storage is done with magnetic recording heads and spinning disks. Now, that's starting to change now with, like, flash memory and things that doesn't involve any moving parts. But for several decades now, high-density data storage has relied on this magnetic head flying over a surface and recording information in a thin film. And so that involves the interaction of extremely smooth surfaces, a high velocity flow in gaps that are only, say, a nanometer or maybe 3 nanometers, I think, is the flying height of a typical head right now, and thin film magnetic materials. And it's been a great success. I mean, and there are, you know, millions of these products in use every day. I heard an analogy at a recent tribology conference, I believe it was the IJTC, about a year ago, somebody talking about the magnetic recording industry in general, and you have this little recording head that's flying on an air bearing just a few nanometers off the surface, and the analogy was made, if you sort of scale the length of the 747 aircraft fuselage and its flying height above the Earth, what is happening in a magnetic recording hard disk is equivalent to a 747 flying about 10 centimeters off the ground. Now, the physics are totally different. It, in the magnetic recording example, it's the air bearing that makes that possible. When those surfaces begin to move with a relative velocity of about a meter per second or so, the head sort of lifts off on its own and begins to fly over the surface, and that's a very stiff bearing. And there's been a lot of work in the last several decades on fluid flow and small gaps, and both from a theoretical and an experimental side, to really understand that, you know, make it stable, and it's been a terrific success.
So you mentioned MEMS. What exactly are those, and how does that relate to the field of nanotribology?
Well, that's an acronym for micro electromechanical systems, and they're small mechanical devices that are either driven by or have as their output electrical signals. And so these were made possible by semiconductor fabrication technologies. These are the same techniques used to make integrated circuits and, you know, our computer processors and memory chips and logic and those sorts of things. What it enables us to do is pattern material down at the micron scale. So typical fabrication sequence for a MEMS device would be something like, you know, you have a substrate. You'll deposit a thin film of some sacrificial material, let's say silicon dioxide, for example. And you'll etch little holes in that silicon dioxide down to the substrate. And those holes are created by spinning photoresist on top of the silicon dioxide, developing that with a pattern through a camera so we can produce sort of micron scale features in that lithography step. You you then are able to etch away the silicon dioxide in specific areas. Then you remove the photoresist. Now you've got a patterned sacrificial layer. You deposit a what we call a structural layer, so it might be another layer of silicon, polycrystalline silicon, on top of that. And all those holes we created previously in the oxide allow you to attach the structural layer down to the substrate. And now you deposit another layer of sacrificial material like SiO2 again. You can do that several times. When you're all done, you put that device in a bath that etches away all the sacrificial material. That's why we call it that. Mm-hmm. The SiO2 goes away, and you're left with these structures standing on the surface. And so those can be of order size scale 1 to 100 microns. And the connection between MEMS and nanotribology then is that because these devices are so small, their apparent areas of contact are on the order of square microns. But the real contact areas, so those surfaces when they touch, those surfaces have roughness just like we understand roughness in our macroscopic world, although it's now of the atomic scale. The real area of contact created by interaction of those rough surfaces is only on the order of tens of square nanometers. And this resembles the number of interacting atoms in, say, an atomic force microscope experiment, or the number of atomic interactions that you could simulate with a modern supercomputer, maybe a few million atoms. So researchers realized early on that this holy grail we talked about earlier, of being able to connect atomistic phenomena that are measurable in nanotribology to some real machine, might be achievable in MEMS because the size scales of, there's just a few asperities. The size scale of those asperities sort of match what's happening in AFM and atomic simulation.
And so it's kind of like a light at the end of the tunnel, and MEMS are a way to that holy grail that you were talking about.
Well, maybe. We have yet to accomplish that. It's still enormously complicated, but the problem now seems a little more tractable.
Well, that's good. So can you talk a little bit about what you're currently working on or in researching?
Sure. So my research in MEMS, that's one of the things that I do, but it involves understanding the relationships between friction, wear, and the reliability of these devices, both during operation and during long periods of storage. You'd like to have, these devices that, you've fabricated and maybe you've characterized very well right after fabrication. You'd like to be able to sit them on the shelf for a long period of time. In our case, for national defense applications, we want to keep those things in storage for maybe 30 years or 50 years and have them operate reliably after that long-term period of storage. So the other, along those lines, I've done a lot of work on surface treatments to improve the friction and wear behavior of these systems, including making the devices out of different materials. People realize when they start working in microsystems is that the fluid lubrication approaches that work so well in our engines and our transmissions and so on cannot be used in microsystems because the associated damping force of trying to move the microsystem through that fluid causes them to operate very slowly. And one of the big advantages of MEMS is that they can be switched very quickly. So they also form capillaries, which increase adhesion forces between these devices. So we really need to limit whatever layers we're going to have on top, the lubrication layer, to a monolayer or two at most. And these lubricants we're using today aren't really anything fancy. We've had great success with just simple linear alcohols. We've shown this to work with things as light as ethanol, that's just two carbon atoms. And we've done a lot of work with pentanol, that's five carbon atoms. And we've been able to demonstrate extremely reliable operation of very complex devices. So for example, we have a tribology test device that, in dry air or dry nitrogen atmospheres might operate for a few thousand cycles, repetitive sliding operations back and forth. With the vapor phase lubrication, we've run these devices for 100 million cycles, and we have to stop the test, actually, because we just sort of get tired of tying up the equipment. There's no wear. These devices run for a very long time. 100 million cycles is about how many engine revolutions you get in the lifetime of your car. You drive your car for 10 years, let's say, 10,000 miles a year or something like that, and you'll put about 100 million revolutions on your engine. We don't typically have engine revolution meters in our car, but that's about the life of an engine. And we put 100 million cycles on one of these devices in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Now we've also developed or demonstrated this technology on more complex structures than a tribology test device. It, by design, has a very simple contact morphology, so we can study what's happening right at the point of contact. But more complex rotating devices that have hubs and gears and all this sort of thing, we've been able to run those at 250,000 RPM for about a billion revolutions until, again, we sort of get bored and quit.
We get bored.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's great. So with the MEMS devices, how do you make those tribological measurements?
Well, it's basically just a process of designing the test devices, and these are, as I mentioned earlier, they're small devices made with the same. They are MEMS devices, but they're tribometers. So they're tribology test devices where we isolate the point of contact. So everything else is the actuators and all the structural components of these devices are suspended off the substrate with springs. And then we have just one point of contact between two movable surfaces. And so we're able then to vary the load, vary the sliding speed, you know, keep those things well controlled during our experiment. Unlike a real MEMS device has rather uncontrolled, don't know exactly where contact is occurring at any given time or what the pressures are at those locations and so on. So we make these devices, we fabricate electrostatic actuators that allow us to move things around. These actuators produce force as a function of the voltage we apply. So in these particular types, the force is directly proportional to the square of the voltage we apply and doesn't change much with small displacements in the actuator. So it's really a very useful actuator to use for tribological measurements. And so the way we make measurements with these devices is we watch them operate under a microscope, and we apply these voltages I talked about with waveform generators that, you know, we prescribe a very specific drive signal. Imagine you know what a sinusoidal wave looks like. We apply that voltage profile to the device, and then we watch how it moves in response to that signal. And since we know the electrical signal we're delivering, we know then the electrical and mechanical forces that develop in the devices. Any sort of phase delay in the motion of the device in response to those signals is due to friction. So that's how we're able to extract friction information from operation of these devices.
So what would you consider to be the most important issues that are facing your field today?
Well, one is certainly in recent times, I think the funding for tribology from government agencies like NSF and Office of Naval Research, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, and so on, has declined. So that's made the environment really challenging for university faculty. But, you know, funding cycles all the time, funding ebbs and flows, and this is really nothing new, and I'm sure that'll pick up again. Another maybe more challenging problem is there's a general reduction in people pursuing advanced degrees to do research. So the shift to service sector kind of jobs and IT jobs mean that there may be reduced opportunities for engineering professionals in the near future. More specifically, I think tribologists sometimes are viewed as pathologists. You know, we get called only when there's a problem or after there's a problem. And most of us realize that it's in the design phase where there's the biggest opportunity to optimize materials or change the design or change how the system operates in order to achieve reliable operation. So as tribologists, we have to continually emphasize the benefits of engaging tribologists and lubrication engineers as early as possible in the development cycle of new systems. And there's also this, more than ever, I think, increasing need for multidisciplinary approach to problems. And tribology is multidisciplinary by nature.
Mm-hmm.
So most professionals in our field already appreciate the value of getting opinions from colleagues in other disciplines. And I think, actually, that's one of the greatest values of STLE membership, in fact. We have members in our society from a whole variety of professions, as well as academia, industry, and government laboratories, and this diverse knowledge base and experience can be tapped into to solve both fundamental scientific problems as well as industrial problems.
Certainly, and that's been a common thread throughout all these interviews is that everyone emphasizes the fact that it is interdisciplinary, and you can search out someone else in that field, and you can, make a jump from one to the other pretty easily, and do different research. So that's a good thing. So have there been any major developments in the field recently that you know about or you've heard about?
Well, in nanotribology specifically, the tools that enable to do experiments in that area just were developed in the 80s. I mean, atomic force microscopy, for example, was originally just developed as a way of making very accurate topographical measurements on surfaces, just sort of seeing roughness down at the atomic scale. But people very quickly realized that you could also measure sort of frictional interactions between the tip and the surface. And so in response to that need, the equipment manufacturers started developing ever better measurement approaches. A lot of this has to do with software and very sophisticated signal processing that enables us to measure, say, energy dissipation and shear or mechanical properties with just a small collection of atoms. From the atomic simulation side, of course, the increase in computing power just continues to march along. We are always getting, faster processors with more memory and things like that. So that's been an evolution that's allowed, larger and larger simulations to be done. The larger simulations, and by large, we mean, either in terms of the number of atoms or the time scale. Typically, atomistic simulations are dealing with femtosecond time steps. So doing a simulation that lasts, say, a microsecond in real time is huge. I mean, that's a very long time to run a simulation. And that limits your ability to capture phenomena that have timescales on that order, on the order of tens of nanoseconds or microseconds. You can't really capture that unless you do a very large simulation. In the area of MEMS, I think the hydrophobic treatment of surfaces, as of about 15 years ago, really enabled batch fabrication of large numbers of these devices with very high yield. Could sort of make these things and they would work initially. But the challenge was still that the coatings, the chemically grafted coatings, wear off pretty easily. And so I think the vapor phase lubrication we've come up with is actually a pretty large development in that area. We've been able to take these sliding surfaces and make them very reliable. One thing that people might not realize about MEMS, it's not immediately obvious, there's no rolling element bearings in micro devices. And bearings are very important to our everyday lives. We have them in our cars and planes, power generation equipment. Bearings are everywhere, and they really limit the amount of energy loss to friction. But in MEMS, we can't make a rolling element bearing. We can just make sort of cookie cutter type parts, with a hole in the center of a gear, for example, that sits on top of a shaft, and that's a journal bearing, is what it's called, a very simple type of bearing. But there's a lot more energy loss there, and there's sliding surfaces involved. So I think that the ability to keep those surfaces lubricated and reliable over, with no wear over long operating lives should enable some development of more complex microsystems in the future. The commercial sector really hasn't caught on to this yet, and our approach obviously is still in the research phase, but this is the pathway to more complex devices that haven't been possible before.
Sure, and that's always a good thing. So what would you say are the conclusions or concepts that listeners should take away from today's discussion? What's the future look like?
Well, nanotechnology is here to stay. This isn't going to be a passing fad, and I think rather than a revolution in commercial products or technology, what we're going to see is nanotechnology sort of slowly creeping in quietly to the products we use every day. This is already happening, in fact. In printers, for example, almost all the print devices, there's a MEMS device in printers that dispenses the ink. In all printers today, accelerometers are in our cars. I mean, there's something like anywhere from four to a dozen MEMS accelerometers in every new automobile. And high-speed switchable antennas, which could be made possible by reliable electrical contacts are, I think, right on the horizon. And so that's going to enable all kinds of improvements in communications technology, like smartphones, battery. Imagine charging your cell phone battery once a month instead of, you know, every few days. And also communication bandwidth. Right now, communication is limited by, in most cases, how fast we can switch. These very fast, reliable MEMS switches will enable technologies like simultaneous transmit and receive. So it should result in enormous improvements in communication bandwidth, for example. So you'll be able to download more YouTube videos or something like that.
Well, that's always good news and always something that I'm looking to do more of. So, thank you so much for joining us today and for your insight.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Kara Lamar. For more news and information and research on nanotribology, the 2011 STLE Annual Meeting, or the International Joint Tribology Conference, you can visit our website at www.stle.org. Both conferences have technical tracks on nanotribology, and the 2011 Annual Meeting will feature a half-day education course on the fundamentals and applications of nanotribology. Thank you for joining us today. This has been another episode of the STLE Compass, pointing you in the right direction.